Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Liz Guinness, and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. Today I'm talking to Lisa Blair. Lisa is a record-breaking sailor, best known for her dangerous solo journey around Antarctica. She also holds the record for being the first woman to circumnavigate Australia by sea. We want to know what it is that drives her to be out on her own for months on end in freezing cold weather and massive seas. So I'm really looking forward to chatting with Lisa today on this episode of Talking Australia. Thank you so much for joining me today, Lisa. Lovely to meet you.
Thanks for having me along.
So how did you, as a young girl growing up on Sunshine Coast, get into sailing? How did that all come about?
It was a little accidental and a little not accidental. So I had my mum, when my folks got divorced, she got right into sailing and into boats. So I had been exposed to boats at a younger age, but it wasn't ever something I wanted to do. It was always her thing, and her new partner's thing. And so I was working on a resort in the Whitsunday Islands just through university summer holidays, and I had seen all of the charter yachts just operating around the region, and I was like, oh, that could be like fun to do for 3 months while I finish my university gap kind of section. And then, so I applied for one company, got the job, and the next day quit on the island and started this new job as a cook and the cleaner on a charter yacht in the Whitsundays, and just fell in love with it. I ended up deferring my uni for a year and staying up there for a year and just learning as much as I could, and then never really stopped.
So at uni, what were you studying at uni that was so easy to defer from, or you just
I was doing a Bachelor of Visual Arts and Bachelor of Education. But I've always been, I guess, one of those people that kind of follows opportunity when it comes knocking. And it was, I had done my internship for my university degree in Africa, teaching in a primary school in Africa.
Oh my goodness, whereabouts?
In Tanzania, in Tanga Town.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah,
so it was a friend of the family just needed a teacher straight away. And so I was on the next flight kind of thing, and just all happened, and I was able to get it counted for uni. But because of that timeline, it meant that I had kind of 6 months till I could do the last section that I needed to do with my course.
Right, to graduate.
To graduate. Yep. And then that was only a couple of weeks of actual schooling required. So it was quite easy to sort of slot it in, so to speak. And I teach sailing now, but I've never actually become an art teacher.
So did you end up graduating then, or was
I graduated, yeah.
Let's rewind a little bit to before you were teaching. You took up that job on the charter boat.
Yes.
How quickly did you transition from cooking and cleaning to actually working with the boat more?
Well, I'm someone that asks a lot of questions, and I instantly was interested in it because I think sailing growing up, I just wasn't old enough to appreciate what the sport was or what it could kind of give you, and how much there was to it. So when I was a bit older and I got exposed to it again, I realized that, you know, it's all this trigonometry and it's catching the wind and it's this, you know, formula of lift and all of the stuff that goes on with sailing. And I kind of found that aspect of it really fascinating, as well as just like, you know, watching a skipper park the boat or fix the engine or do some electrical work on the boat, and they could just, a jack of all trades, they could just fix everything. And it just hugely impressed me. And so I started just asking lots of questions, and I literally, like, me and my deckhand, he would like quiz me at nighttime, what's the name of that rope and what's the name of that rope? And I would just try and learn that way. And I think it was about 3 months or so until I transitioned from that boat onto another boat where I was deck/host. So I ran the deck and all down below as well. So the skipper would say, all right, we need to do this. And then I would go and, and do that. And then I would also have the food in the oven at the same time.
Oh,
and
multitasking.
And kind of be balancing the schedule for both things. So, yeah. So, and that was good. And I did that for about a year, I think. Yeah.
And then what? Where did you sail onto then?
Well, I was trying to get out of the galley, and I wasn't getting any opportunities within that company to do that. Mm-hmm. So I decided to leave the company and finish those couple of weeks of university that I had. And on the very last, like almost the day I finished my course and actually graduated, I had a friend from uni call me up and say, "Hey, I'm in Fiji. I'm sailing with my dad to Hawaii. Can you get here in a week? We need another crew member. Are you interested?"
I'm like, "I can get there tomorrow."
Yeah. So I packed up again and jumped on a plane and flew to Samoa and met this boat. And then we spent sort of 3 months cruising through the Pacific Islands over to Hawaii. Oh, and wow. He didn't have a sat phone or anything. So we were completely off the grid for 3 months. And it was just this surreal experience. And I'd never sailed across an ocean and stood watch at nighttime and done those kind of things. And there was sort of six of us or five of us on board the boat, so we would do 2 hours on and sort of 8 hours off, and so it was just this huge adventure, and I just loved it, so I just kept wanting more.
Was it a bigger boat? No, smaller boat than what
I learned on. It was a little 40-foot steel boat called mm-hmm. Bird of Dawning. We used to call it the Rooster, and much to the owner's disgust.
I bet.
Sorry, Keith. and he was moving over there. He's an American, and he's an architect, so he was moving over there to sort of build a house for his friend mm-hmm. in Hawaii. So, and he was going to live on the boat.
So when you say stand watch at night, what does that mean? What do you...
So you can't kind of just let a boat sail, because there's lots of things you can hit, including other boats and container ships and islands and reefs and,
okay,
and all of that.
Okay, obviously out in the middle of the ocean, not as likely to hit an island. So you'd be looking for more things like the bigger ships?
Traffic, and also like the wind changes. It's not a constant direction, so mm-hmm. it will fluctuate 10, 20 degrees throughout a night. So basically standing watch, you're just keeping an eye out for any shipping and any unknown, you know, foreign items and mm-hmm. stuff. You do see a fair bit of space debris come in the middle of the ocean and
really?
Stuff like that. Yeah, you just see this flashes of colour falling from the sky, and, yeah, it can be really surreal
wow,
sometimes.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah.
You then, I'm not sure how long between, but you became part of a crew that sailed around the world?
Yes. So I came back from Hawaii and I had $0 again, as the story of my life. And so I got the first job I could get, which was selling costume jewelry in the mall for $5. So it's these $5 bits of plastic. You sell them at one of those little stalls that's in the centre, like a temporary kind of stall.
Sydney? Were you back in Sydney?
No, this is the Sunshine Coast. Okay. While I was there, my mum's partner had noticed I had this interest in sailing now. So he started lending me all these books on sailors. And so I started reading about solo sailing and Robert Knox Johnson and Kay Cotty and Jesse Martin and all these historical kind of figures in sailing. And at the same time, I was sort of formulating this kind of background idea that solo sailing might be something I'd like to try one day. I had no idea when or how or, you know, what that would look like, mm-hmm. but it interested me.
Why did it interest you, just as a matter of interest?
I like the additional challenge of being on a boat on your own. So mm-hmm. there's no one else to rely on. So if literally it's hitting the fan, you have to step up and be strong enough and be hard enough and make that work. And if you're tired, who cares? You've got to get it done. Like, there's no one there that you can kind of skip out on and let them do it for you and take a rest. Like, it pushes you to another level that you don't get otherwise with sailing. So,
and is that something that you find you need in other areas of your life as well?
No, sailing's enough.
Okay, just the sailing then.
No, I mean, I like adventure, and sailing gives me that sense of adventure, and sailing solo gives me the sense of challenge and achievement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really like planning big projects, because that level of planning that has to go into something like that, it takes like a whole year or more to actually make sure you've ticked all the boxes and you've made the trip safe and you've built the redundancies and the backups. And so that research that goes into the beginning side of those projects is really interesting as well, because, you know, I'm learning about different weather patterns and this and that and structures of the vessel and what systems work, what won't work. And
yep.
So I'm constantly kind of learning. And I think I've always sort of had a thirst to kind of challenged my knowledge, and that sort of filtered down through my sailing and why it's led me to the kind of sailing that I've done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So back to the round the world race. There was a team of how many of you?
Yeah. So I found out about the race through Robin's book, and I spent 12 months fundraising, and I raised $80,000 to go and compete in the race.
Oh, gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah. So it was like my first big challenge where I had no money and tried to make something possible. And then on board, there's 10, it's the Clipper Round the World Yacht Race, and there's 10 identical boats that race each other around the world in like a match racing kind of thing. And you race country to country, basically, or racetrack. You might have two races in one leg. And on board, you have anywhere from sort of 15 to 20 people and one professional skipper. And 10 of you on each boat do the whole circumnavigation. And then we have what are called leggers, can come in and do one leg of the journey.
Okay.
So, and it's 8 sections for the whole race. So, yeah, so it was, for me, I needed a platform that I could learn in, because I had, you know, very basic level of knowledge. And if I ever wanted to do something like solo sailing, I had to learn how to fix an engine, how to repair sails, how to fly a spinnaker, how to navigate, like, and I didn't know that stuff yet. So I decided that the Clipper race would be a really good crash course in learning. And so I signed up, and it was, I kind of left with an amateur level of experience and came back with enough knowledge to be a captain. So, you know, it's a 12-month, very intensive
training course on the job. And so then you got into solo sailing. How did that all come about?
Yeah, so I was, when I got back from the Clipper race, I got all my commercial tickets. So I became a captain in the industry, and I started skippering boats in the Whitsundays. And I found out about a yacht race called the Solo Trans-Tasman Yacht Race, which runs once every 4 years from New Zealand to Australia. And my family hadn't really been able to be a part of the Clipper that much because we were in so many different foreign countries. And this race, you actually sailed back into Mooloolaba, which is my home port. So I thought that that would be a really nice way to sort of launch into solo sailing. I was the only female to sign up, and I was the only person without a boat. So minor details.
Yes.
I had a year to figure out how to get a boat. And so I was sort of ringing people and calling boat brokers and anyone who had a boat up for sale and trying to convince them to charter me a boat. And I called this guy up, James Buick, and he had this Open 40 racing yacht, which is a smaller version of your Hugo Boss racing yacht, super sexy, you know, lovely boat, kind of the one that we would have wet dreams about with sailing.
Part of the pun.
Yeah, exactly. No pun intended, but part of the pun. And so I was talking to him, and I was trying to really hard to convince him to charter me his boat. And he was like, look, it's up for sale. I don't want to charter it. You can buy the boat and it's not that expensive. Maybe if you roll this campaign in with a bigger one, you've got a bigger chance of actually raising the money. And he said, have you heard about this Fedor Konyakov guy who's doing this Antarctica circumnavigation? Yep. And I was like, no, what's that? And he's like, oh, I was actually looking at it, but now we've got kids and you know, my wife's pregnant again, and I don't want to kind of go down that path anymore. So you should have a look at this trip. It was what I was looking to do with my boat. And so I had a longer look at it, and it was Fedor Konyakov in 2008 circumnavigated Antarctica without stops in 102 days.
He's a Russian.
Russian sailor, yeah. And he's sort of a jack of all trades. He's this Russian, crazy Russian adventurer. Sorry, Oskar Konyakov, I didn't call your father crazy.
I've heard he looks a little like Rasputin. Is that true?
Yeah. And he's like, he's hot air ballooned around the world. He's, you know, rowed across oceans. He's currently rowing around the world in the Southern Ocean, and he's almost at Cape Horn, having left from New Zealand. So he's at sea at the moment on a little rowboat.
Oh my Lord.
At 69 years of age.
Oh my goodness.
Like, and he's this Russian guy with this massive beard, and just, it is the loveliest person. And
slightly mad, I'm wondering.
Well, you know, I think he's very spiritual. So he uses that a lot through his adventure to get him through. And yeah, so anyway, I found out about this trip, and my instant response was, there's no way. Like, I raced in those oceans when I did the Clipper Around the World Yacht Race, and there's no way that that kind of journey would be doable on my own as a 5'2" little girl. And but then I kind of started looking at it, and I was trying to raise the money for the Trans-Tasman, and I was trying to combine it with something that was achievable. And from a sponsorship point of view, it's got to be a unique project and large project
capture
to really...
people's imagination.
Exactly, and to capture the market for, you know, for your sponsors to get a return. And so I was sort of juggling all of these things, and I started researching what the weather was going to be like down there and what's the worst possible conditions you can kind of likely face, and how cold would it be, and where was the iceberg line, and, and you know, going through all of the, that kind of process. And after about 3 months, I kind of came to the conclusion that it was possible. I then, sorry, we just had a sign fall down in the room. I then called Mum and started throwing the idea to her about doing this trip. And she was absolutely adamant that I don't go. And she's like, you're not there yet. Don't, it's too risky. Like, no. And I was like, okay, I'll just sort of table it a little bit. But the idea was there now, and I kind of wanted to do it, but I hadn't really made that 100% commitment to it yet. And I sort of started down the road of preparing for Antarctica. And it wasn't really until I completed the Trans-Tasman yacht race and I raced back to Australia in this little tiny sort of 32-foot boat that I asked Mum again, and I was like, so what do you think about this Antarctica idea? And she was like, I guess you're experienced enough now, and gave her blessing, and so I committed to the project and off we went.
That's and a brave mum. Brave mum, brave girl.
Yeah, so, and then it took me another sort of 2.5 years trying to raise any kind of money to get the boat, and then 3.5 years till I actually left from that moment. So it was a bit of a long slog.
So you sailed out from Albany in Western Australia?
Yes.
And then which direction were you heading? How did it all pan out?
Yeah, so for me to be eligible for a world record, I had to do the same racetrack as Fedor Konyakov. So he raced on something called the Antarctica Cup Ocean Race, and he raced on the Antarctica Cup Ocean Race racetrack, which was sticking between 45 degrees south, which is kind of just below Tasmania, and 60 south, which is just above kind of the Antarctic Peninsula, if you kind of think of that section of the ocean. And he left from Albany in Western Australia. So when he left, he went straight south to a gate entry onto this racetrack and then did this whole circumnavigation between 45 and 60 south. So to make myself eligible for his record, I also left from Albany and I went straight south, and then I entered into the racetrack and I did the whole circumnavigation between 45 and 60. So I turned left and I went in a clockwise direction around Antarctica.
I imagine there's all sorts of hurdles in those waters, huge seas, cold, icebergs,
all of them,
storms, massive waves.
Yeah.
What was it? How did you cope with all of that?
Varying degrees of success, generally okay. I'm a big believer that for something like this, you have to trust the boat. You have to know that the boat's the right boat for the job, that it can get you through those storms. And if you don't trust that, all you're doing is you're doubting constantly as the massive storms roaring around you. You're like, is this wave going to roll us? Is this wave going to get us? Or is that wind too strong? And, you know, and you're kind of like running a commentary in your head of doubt. And you can't have that when you're in those conditions and out in those storms. And if you imagine like the center of a cyclone, you're in that kind of once a week at sea. So you're kind of, how to describe it, two-story, three-story buildings as waves.
Oh, Lord.
And then what happens when the wind comes is it breaks the top of the wave. It doesn't throw the whole wave over like you would see at the beach here, but the very top kind of 2-3 meters of the wave curls over like a mini sort of wave at the beach. Mm. And then that causes sort of like 1 meter to 2 meters of white water that will hit the boat. And the white water has a lot of pressure behind it. So 1 square meter of whitewash is 1 ton of pressure applied. Wow. So you're thinking a 30-foot wave with 3 meters of white water roaring down at you, that kind of slaps into the boat and just throws you. So you can get thrown 50, 60 meters in a 10-ton boat like you weigh a matchstick. So
how does that feel?
Well, it's not fun.
No. I would say horrifying. Not fun is another way.
But I guess through my research and everything, I knew what I was coming into, and I knew because I'd sailed in those conditions with crew, with the Clipper race, I trusted that boat so much, and I trusted my skipper's calls in the Clipper around the World Yacht Race in those conditions, that I knew it was survivable. And I hadn't really tested my boat in those conditions yet. So once the first really big storm was through, I knew that we could basically take what was coming at us. But you've got to just kind of prepare as best as you can, and then you go inside the boat and minimize risk. And if I'm on deck, I'm at risk of getting washed by a wave or hit or washed overboard, or, you know, maybe break my leg or my arm. And as a solo sailor, I'm the weakest link. So it's all about protecting me, keeping me safe and not in an area where I can get thrown around the cabin or anything like that. But generally, as the storm would approach, I would always have some nerves. And then in the full thick of it, if the boat was doing well, I would just admire it, because it's one of the most magical things to see, is to be in the eye of a storm in the middle of the ocean, completely on your own, and know that you're going through it okay, and be able to just sit there and look at it and watch it. And you know, sometimes the wind's blowing so strong that you have to turn your head away from the wind to actually get a breath of air, because there's so much water in the air as it's getting ripped off the top of the waves. And, you know, it's just this incredible experience that's it's really hard to describe, but it's, for me, it's always magical to actually see those storms and be in them. I love it.
We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment with Lisa Blair. We have a special offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's three issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you'll also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. In between the storms and the smooth sailing, we get to a point, I think it was about 1,000 nautical miles off South Africa, and something goes terribly wrong.
Yeah, so I had sailed 3/4 of the way around Antarctica, and for me, Cape Horn was highlighted as the highest risk kind of section of the voyage. And I had sailed past Cape Horn and past a body of water known as Iceberg Alley, which is, you know, that's always nerve-wracking. And then I was just sailing out of the South Atlantic Ocean and into the South Indian Ocean, which would have been the last 4 weeks at sea.
So kind of the home stretch.
Home stretch, yeah, definitely. And I was starting to really think about home and what's that going to be like and what's going to happen and, you know, all of those kind of thoughts. And when you're at sea solo, you still have to keep a fairly good watch. So I don't ever really sleep longer than sort of 20 to 40 minutes on a journey like that. So it's lots of little naps, and you're constantly in a high level of exhaustion, and you're just trying to function as much as you can in that exhaustion. And I do something called sleep banking, where it doesn't matter what the conditions are like or how tired or rested I am, I will always sleep as much as I can, because you never quite know when the next emergency or the next disaster might occur, and you can't actually sleep for 2 days or, you know, whatever. So I was napping, as I did, and I had been up 20 minutes earlier and kind of checked on things, and the boat was going well. My average day in the Southern Ocean, in the Atlantic Ocean specifically, was basically sort of 30 to 50 knots of wind and waves that were sort of 6 to 8 meters on average.
That's average. Wow.
That was like, it was mostly storms through the Atlantic, whereas the Pacific, I had the low, high system.
Right.
Whereas the Atlantic was just low. Very few highs. And so I was just in these rough conditions, but I'd been in them for weeks, and it was no different to any other kind of day at sea. And I was laying in bed, and out of nowhere I just heard bang, and it was like something had snapped, but it sounded so loud that it sounded like a gunshot had gone off, because it was like this ringing in your ears as it echoed through the boat.
Oh, my goodness.
And I sort of jumped up onto my engine box, which is in the center of the boat. And I have this Perspex dome that's above me that I can see out. And the idea of that was to prevent my exposure, so I didn't always have to go outside to keep a good watch. Yeah. And so I was on that, and I looked to the back of the boat thinking the problem was there, and that was totally fine. And I looked to the front of the boat, and I could just see my 22-meter-long mast kind of jellying around like a hula girl, shaking her hips. Uh-huh. And I realized that my mast, like my piece of rigging wire, had snapped. So that was pretty terrifying. And then I grabbed my life jacket, because the next thing you can do is you can change direction, which is called a tack, mm-hmm. and put the pressure of the wind and everything on the other side of the rigging where it's not damaged. So I grabbed my life jacket, and I was just climbing outside the hatch as I heard the whole mast snap and come crashing down. And it's this gut-wrenching sort of sound of metal on metal grinding and screeching, and the whole boat shudders as all the forces applied to the boat change and shift. So she's shaking and flexing, and you can, and it's so loud. And and at that point I was 1,000 nautical miles directly south of South Africa. And I had a new storm just developing and coming through, so the conditions were going to worsen through the night.
So what did you do?
Well, the biggest risk in that situation is that when the mast snaps is you have it still attached to the boat, and you have all the forces applied to that mast of the wind and the waves and everything. So what was happening was the mast was kind of seesawing on the deck. It had snapped at deck level and rotated the boat 180 degrees so that the mast was to the waves and the boat was to the leeward side of the mast. And by this stage, the conditions had started to develop and get worse, and I was starting to get that 1 meter of white water that's applying one ton of pressure. And, you know, so as I'm there, it's kind of still on the deck a little bit, but any second a wave can rip it off the deck and actually push it through the center hull of the boat and sink you, flood you and sink you. So that was it was kind of like a battle against time and trying to race and get it disconnected, and also trying to look at how to disconnect it in a way that didn't compound the scenario and make it worse, because it would allow it to fall off.
Yep.
Or, you know, so it was just a lot of juggling with that, a lot of fear. And the whole time you're in a boat that's now stricken. So now that the boat is stationary, there's nothing propelling it forward. The waves weren't passing under the boat, they were passing over the boat. So every sort of 30 seconds, you get a wall of water just come over, and you'd be on your hands and knees on the deck trying to hold on, and you'd be completely submerged underwater, throughout all of that. So you're trying to hold on to tools, keep a hold of the boat. You're attached to the boat, to the tether. But if you're in the water, it's so hard to climb back on board, and freezing conditions. Yeah. So the air temperature was 2 degrees at the time. And I had gone on deck and had a quick look, and I managed to get completely soaked through in that quick look without protection, like without foul weather gear on. And then I went inside and got kitted up to deal with the emergency and grabbed some tools and went back up on deck. And by that stage, I was already completely soaked through to the bone, even though I have waterproofing gear over the top now. But it meant that throughout the night, I actually succumbed to hypothermia. And with the waves pushing and pulling the mast constantly, it was actually cutting the boat in half. I had like this kind of 30 centimeter long hole in the side of the boat where it was kind of seesawing on top of, and it was
that pressure.
Yeah. And it was just literally slicing the boat in half. So I did disconnect a couple of pieces of rigging, and I had issued a pan-pan to my shore manager. So a pan-pan is one step below a mayday. A mayday is I require immediate assistance, I'm at immediate risk of loss of life or vessel, whereas a pan-pan is I require assistance, but I'm not at immediate risk of loss of life or vessel. And the difference is, like a mayday, they would send, you know, the Australian Navy would come down kind of thing, whereas a pan-pan, they may divert a passing ship.
So it sounded pretty dire to me. Why did you decide a pan-pan instead of a mayday?
Because the boat was still floating, and the boat wasn't sinking or in a position to sink yet.
Yeah.
So it was still, in a way, a recoverable scenario. And I had briefed with different riggers and shipwrights before I even left on how to deal with an emergency such as this, and what would the steps be, and what was the options and everything. And so yes, I could have got washed overboard. Yes, a lot of different things could have happened. But also help was 3 days away.
Mm.
You know, the closest ship to me was 600 miles away. So even if they motored full throttle, which they couldn't do in that kind of sea state, they would have taken 3 days to get to me. So
you had to fix it.
Exactly. And like I always kind of knew that with that trip because I was going to such a remote part of the world that rescue is simply not an option. The second last piece of rigging was the forestay wire. And that's the very forward piece of rigging wire that goes to the very top of the mast.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it had kind of fallen, it had blocked my access to the disconnecting pin that I was trying to knock out. And I had the option of kind of wedging my arm underneath it and knocking it out that way. But the second it lets go, it kind of becomes a weapon and it whips around the deck. And I had a high chance that it would break my arm or further injure me.
Yeah.
And then I'd be stuffed because I couldn't do anything with a broken arm on board the boat. And the other option was to climb over the safety rails at the very front of the boat and sit down on the bowsprit and separate it from there. But out there, given how much the waves were breaking over the boat, I had maybe a 50-50 shot of coming back inside the rails. I remember calling my shore manager up and giving him an update. And he's like this super jovial kind of guy, Jeff. And he's like, I said to him, I've released the backstay and the inner forestay. And he's like, well done, Lisa. We're all behind you here in Australia. Like, keep going. Like, you're doing well.
Thanks.
And I remember just being like, you have no idea what's coming next. And I told him that the next thing I need to do is go out onto the bowsprit and that I, you know, was in these conditions and the level of risk associated. And he was like, right, okay, I understand. And then I said to him that I have my PLB, which is a personal location beacon attached to my life jacket, which is like an EPIRB.
Yep.
And I said to him that if I get washed off the bow, I'm going to trigger my EPIRB, which means that basically don't come and get me because I would have been in the water and you'd be recovering a body. So that was the kind of level of conversation.
Quite a conversation to have.
Yeah, it was quite a stressful one. It was quite a quick one too because I was still in, I need to get this done,
of course,
like now.
Emergency mode. Yeah.
And so I hung up the phone. I went up to the front of the deck and I remember sort of getting about 2 meters from the bow and completely freezing with fear, like just frozen, like I couldn't move forward. But I had to get it done and there was no other options. And I was watching the waves and I was still running through every possible scenario in my head, like there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a safer
something
option. There's
got to
be something I've missed. Mm. And I just couldn't come up with anything else in that situation, in that moment in time. And it was too wet to use an angle grinder. A hacksaw would take too long. And I was just sort of running through all these things in my head. And so I just took the leap and I jumped up and I sat down at the front. And I thought I would be able to kind of lock my legs in underneath the bowsprit.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out I'm really short. And I can't.
Hadn't figured that out.
Figured that out in the worst possible moment in time.
That's right.
So I ended up kind of gripping with my thighs and then I had my left hand on what was left of my rail, which was kind of buckled and twisted to the side. And my right hand held the hammer and my left hand had a screwdriver. And I had to wait until the gaps between the waves. And basically what was happening was in the moonlight, you could see a wave coming at you from the left and you would see the white water roaring down. And I would just kind of hug the boat as much as I could. And then as soon as it passed and I was no longer underwater, the next second I would have to let go completely and put my screwdriver in the split pin and hammer with the hammer to try and knock the split pin out and then see the next wave come and kind of grip on again. And you'd get like sort of 5 or 6 seconds of actual work in. I called Jeff back up and said I did it. And he was like, thank God for that.
Good job, Lisa. Australia's cheering for you.
And then I got the last pieces finished. And I had put a retrieval line on the mast. And the intention was to let it stay there and wait for the storm to pass. And in the calm between the storm, try and recover what I could off the mast, or maybe I could use it and step it as a new mast or do something with it. However, because I was kind of getting lifted 6-7 meters by these waves, as soon as I kind of separated the last piece of rigging, the mast started to sink and then I got pulled up and the line snapped and I lost everything.
So you lost it.
Yeah. I'd managed to keep my boom, which is the horizontal piece of kind of mast that you see the mainsail flies off.
Yep.
But that was the only thing I'd managed to save that night.
So the sun comes up, you do the repairs as best you can, but you don't have a mast.
I don't have a mast, but I do have an engine. So I have 250 litres of fuel on board, which wasn't going to be enough to get me to South Africa. But that day I had a message come through from the Maritime Rescue Coordination Centre in Cape Town, and they had, unbeknown to me, diverted the closest container ship to my aid, which was 600 miles away at the time. And they basically had asked me, do I want a rescue? And I said to them, no, the boat's floating. I want to get the boat home and I'm okay. I haven't had any major injury or anything. But is there a possibility of doing a fuel transfer or getting some fuel from this ship?
Mm-hmm.
Because then I can actually motor the rest of the way to South Africa and then make repairs from there and a new plan. And so they spoke to the master of the ship. He said, okay. The ship started motoring south. I kept going north. And it took us 3 days to intercept in the Southern Ocean. And I had requested that they put all available fuel into containers and tie the containers together and throw them into the water and then with a float on it. And then I'd pick it up from the water and I'd just pull them all in. However, when I got there, I quickly learned that it was a Chinese-owned container ship crewed by Korean-speaking sailors. And they had no real concept of the weakness of a fiberglass built boat. And so when I arrived, they had a 44-gallon drum on the deck of the ship and a bowser line hanging off the side of the ship like I was going to fuel up like I'm at a fuel station. And they had two fenders out. And their fenders were two tires hanging off the side of the ship at the middle of the ship on the leeward side. So as they were rolling in the 6-meter swell, those tires would sort of touch the water and then the next minute be 10 meters up in the air. And if I had been foolish enough to actually take a line or take two lines and tie up, they would have hung the boat completely out of the water and snapped it in the center.
Oh, my gosh, of course.
Because the boat's not designed to be hung from bow and stern. And it would have literally just snapped the boat in half and sunk it. So I was refusing and we ended up in like a Mexican standoff. And I managed to convince the ship to please put all the containers in the water, tied together with a float on them, and I'll collect them from the sea. And they finally did it.
Which is what you wanted 12 hours earlier.
Exactly, yes.
So you're in South Africa, you're in Cape Town, and then...
with a very broken boat.
Yes, and I imagine most people would think, that's it. I've tried as hard as I can, but it's not in my favour. But that's not you.
No, like it's something that I spent so many years working on, like just 3.5 years of complete commitment. So that's no socializing with friends, no partying, no like having a relationship, living in a tiny hovel of a house to put every bit of scent that I earned into the project. And I just was so focused on that end goal. My total goal, beating Fedor Konyakov's record was like a bonus. And it was something I could use for the media and the marketing and stuff. But my real goal was to safely sail the whole way around Antarctica and come back alive.
Mm.
And, like, I'd sailed 3/4 very well and I had this issue that had occurred, which turned out to be electrolysis with the rigging, caused the demasting, and I had managed to survive that scenario. But now I needed to get the boat home and I wanted to get the boat home and I could wait 4 months or 5 months for winter to pass and then sail the boat back and void the record completely and maybe try again next year. But I also emotionally didn't know if I could cope with being back in that scenario a year later and fighting it and just the doubt of the demasting and everything. So I decided that, well, I was initially super depressed when I was just making my way back to South Africa and I just kept trying to remind myself, like, just focus on getting to land, just focus on getting to land and just focus on safety and you know, worry about that later.
Yep.
And then I worked out through a conversation that there was the potential that I could restart the record from South Africa and do it with one stop. And so we started talking to our insurance company and they were brilliant, Edward Williams Marine Insurance and Northern Reef, and they came on board in a big way. So I, in all of my refit time, I had this insane refit where I was just, you know, getting 3 hours sleep a night, just go, crazy jobs list to do and just trying to get to the start. And in and amongst all of that, I'd filled out the insurance paperwork online. And what I had done was a typo. And so instead of my boat was insured for $250,000, but the mast, you've got to allocate sections to different parts of the boat. So you might put some to the hull, some to the rigging, yada, yada, yada. And for me, I thought I had put $120,000 to the mast and it said $20,000. So I approached the CEO with a sponsorship profile and I said, look, if I did the Sydney to Hobart straight after when we get back, and if you can meet me halfway with $60,000, and then I can find a secondhand mast and with sponsors and donations, I might be able to get it together. Whereas with 20,000, there's no way that I could pull that off in time. And so they agreed. So they came on board for another 40,000.
Fantastic.
And so I had $60,000 budget for the mast and the rigging and the sails. And my sailmakers, Quantum Sails, were awesome. And the riggers in Cape Town were great. I had the wire shipped over from Australia from Arcus Wire, who was my sponsor. And everyone else, like the ropes, everyone just like pitched in and like helped out where they could, and where they couldn't do it completely, no charge. They would only charge me the cost of it actually to them rather than, you know, inflating that. And the whole community of sailing like got behind me and supported it.
Everyone was on board.
Yeah. And I tried to find a secondhand mast and I found one in Australia for $15,000 and it was going to cost me $40,000 to get it to Cape Town. And then I started hunting around in Africa in general. And I was like, getting something by truck over land would be so much cheaper than like trying to buy one. Mm. And a brand new mast was $60,000 in South Africa. And so I had been hosted by this lovely family, Deb and Ray. And they were just a couple of people who knew through the International Sailing Network and knew about my plight. They offered for me to stay with them for the whole time that I was there. So I basically moved in with them and they got on the phone to everyone that they knew in different yacht clubs and anyone in the cruising community and said, you know, anyone know of a mast? Anyone know of a mast? And we just did the ring around and we found a boat called Thunderchild. And it turned out that they had changed their mast from aluminium to carbon fiber like 10 years earlier. And they still had the original mast sitting in a shed in South Africa. And so I picked up this mast that's 2 meters shorter than my old mast, but it fit and it would get me home. And I picked it up for like 5,000 Australian.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, through all of that and the chaos and trying to import stuff, and it took 2 months, but I was able to go again.
So you're back on the water. You have to head back down to where the mast broke in the first place to restart the record. Is that right?
Yeah. So the intention for me was always, I had a couple of options. I could just sail back to Australia, or what I really wanted to do was sail back to the position of demasting, cross that track, and then finish the record, keeping within that racetrack of 45 and 60 south to finish it as if I had never had the demasting effectively. The difference was that it was now winter. We were about 2 or 3 weeks into winter, and I had spoken to my meteorologist, Bob McDavitt, in New Zealand, quite extensively about what the worst conditions were likely to be in winter, what could I expect. And I juggled what he had said and what I'd found out on my own, and I'd spoken to a few other people and other cruisers that had spent some time in Antarctica, and I sort of worked out that it was capable of doing the trip in winter. And the main difference we could see was that the swell would be larger, the storms would be more frequent, but not any greater severity than what I'd already encountered. And it would just be a lot colder. So I decided to continue and tried another technique with my boat that I hadn't tried yet called hoving to, which is basically where in really, really rough storm conditions, you stall the sails out and the boat drifts sideways to the waves. And what happens is it creates this slick in the water where you've disturbed the water and it makes the waves break on the slick instead of on the boat. Uh-huh. And it's like this old technique that a lot of ancient sailors use, but it's normally done on boats that have a really big keel, and my boat has a racing keel, which is a really narrow, small keel, and I didn't think it would have the same effect on my boat. And it didn't work perfectly, but it worked enough for me to get through. So I started sailing for a day, and then when the 15 meter waves would hit, I would hove to, ride out the waves, and then sail for a day, hove to through the 15 meter waves again, sail for a day, and so on and so forth. And it took me another 5 days to get to the position of demasting. I did get flipped 180 degrees by a wave, so completely upside down and then back up.
Oh my God.
And I was knocked down like every 30 minutes, I'd be horizontal from a wave, like just smashing into the side of the boat and knocking you horizontal. So that was like kind of my new normal. And
that's terrifying.
Yeah. Going upside down was terrifying.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And and sometimes the waves would hit the side of the hull with such violence that I thought it actually cracked the hull, and I'd have to get up on deck and look because it had such a cracked sound to it with the impact. Mm. And what happens is it doesn't just hit you, it throws you, but you're at the peak of a 30-foot wave, and then it throws you to the bottom of the wave. And so you impact on this, like, almost like cement. So the boat, like, kind of hits the cement and crunch, and everything gets violently jolted, like a car crash kind of thing. So for me, I was, like, refusing to go anywhere in the boat. I would be in my bunk, tied in, and that was it, like riding out these storms kind of thing. And you'd bring a few snacks and some water and try and avoid having to go to the toilet for the next 12 hours.
Breathe through it.
Yeah, basically. And try not to let your mind create too much, you know, thinking about it.
The mental strength that you have is unspeakable. Oh.
So, and then the same day I crossed my position of demarcy, I got my first blizzard at sea. And I had like 2 inches of snow dumped on the deck of the boat. And I can tell you one of the most painful experiences is putting in shortening sail in a blizzard, because you don't have gloves on because you've got to use the ropes, and you've got wind, 50 knots of wind, pelting snow into your face, and you're trying to see what you're doing, and it's just, yeah, it's very painful.
to say the least, I would imagine, to say the least.
And then the interesting thing that did happen, though, was once I started actually heading with the weather, it all kind of calmed down because I'm pacing with the wind and with the storms, so it sort of spread the storms out a bit more. And I knew by that point I was going to achieve this, or I should, in theory, achieve this. I had 4 weeks to go, and I just had to ride it out now. And so that, like, really impacted my mental health and made me a lot more positive. And the small things that were all big problems before suddenly weren't such a big problem. And, and I sort of just slowly took in those last couple of weeks at sea. So. Mm.
And so you sailed back in, is it 182 days after you left?
Yeah, so the official record time's 182 days. What that means is that they count all the time that I'm in South Africa as well, so they don't stop the clock through all of that. So we also tried to see how far off Fedor Konyakov's record I would have been if I didn't stop. Mm-hmm. And so we did a mock-up time of taking out the moment I demasted to the moment I crossed my track again to see where I would have finished, and I was 1 day behind him.
So close.
That was with a new mast, which I'm sailing slower and I'm more careful, and in winter, and so I was 1 day ahead of him when I demasted, so I had a really good shot of actually breaking his record. And when I initially finished this trip, I sort of felt like I'd kicked all the goals, like I'd survived, I'd gone around, I'd done something most men wouldn't do, let alone women, and I'd done it against all odds. Whereas a couple of years later, I'm now kind of like, maybe I'll find my way back to Antarctica shortly, and I kind of want to go back and break his record. So
is that on the cards, truly?
On the cards, yeah. Yeah, it's something I'm working towards at the moment. And then I've also got my eyes on maybe doing a circumnavigation around the Arctic. So...
Well, it's no sitting still for you, is it?
No.
Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing all of that with us.
You're welcome.
And please, please, please come back and tell us more about your sailing endeavours really soon.
Yes, definitely. And people can follow, through my social media and my website and everything. I blog every day at sea, so you can come along for the ride.
You find time to blog.
I blog almost 1,000 words a day, actually. Yeah, surprisingly enough. Just sort of tell people what happened, what I ate for lunch. And sometimes it's really interesting and other times not so much.
I'm sure everyone will want to stay tuned. For yeah. Sure. Thanks so much, Lisa.
Awesome. Thank you.
Cheers. That's it for this episode of Talking Australia. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening, and hear you next time.